Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 50th anniversary of the Watts Rebellion in Los Angeles on August the 11th, 1965, and speak with Johnny Scott, a professor of Africana Studies at California State University, Northridge, who grew up in Watts and witnessed the revolt firsthand. He is the co-founder of the Watts Writers Workshop and served on the board of the Watts branch of the NAACP and was a co-founder of the Studio Watts Workshop with James Wood, Maya Angelou, James Cortez, and Ornette Coleman. We'll discuss the familiar pattern that has sparked a series of uprisings since Watts, police harassing, beating, or killing African Americans after a traffic stop, and assess improvements made since, in light of the fact that unemployment amongst black youth in America stands at 30%. Then we'll speak with Ari Berman, a political correspondent for The Nation and the author of the new book just out, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We'll discuss this powerful story of rights won and rights lost in the long struggle to get the Voting Rights Act passed and the counter-revolution against it, in which Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, played a pivotal role, as well as Ari Berman's article at Politico, Inside John Roberts' Decade-Long Crusade Against the Voting Rights Act. Then finally, we'll examine the disconnect between Donald Trump continuing to lead in the Republican primary polls while the punditry continues to write off his chances of winning the nomination. Alan Lichtman, an American political historian at American University who has studied both the American right and the presidency, joins us. We will discuss Trump's lead in the latest Iowa poll and Jeb Bush's plummet from third place to seventh in the Real Clear Politics average of Iowa polls over the last month. And joining us now is Johnny Scott, who's an associate professor and director of external and community projects at the Department of Africana Studies at California State University, Northridge. He was one of the original founding members of the Watts Writers Workshop, formed in October of 1965 by Oscar award-winning writer Bud Schulberg, 2 months following the Watts Revolt, and he received an Emmy for his participation and work on the NBC national documentary, The Angry Voices of Watts. He attended the 1966 White House conference to fulfill these rights, called by then President Lyndon Johnson, where he represented the Watts community. In the immediate aftermath of the revolt, he served as a member of the board of directors of the Watts branch of the NAACP and was one of the co-founders of the Sons of Watts, the Greater Watts Justice Center, the Studio Watts Workshop, with James Wood, Maya Angelou, Ornette Coleman, and Jane Cortez, and the Mafundi Institute with Bill Marshall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Johnny Scott.
Oh, well, thank you. Glad to be here.
And Johnny, you were at Harvard College as about an 18-year-old. You got a full scholarship to Harvard College. You were back, I guess, from Harvard in Watts 50 years ago today. And then all hell broke loose.
That's, in a word, yes. Yes, that was came back in June of 65, and then August 10th. Today is when it happened.
And what was your first vision of it? Because in many of the interviews that have been held on this 50th anniversary, I was just listening today to a prominent civil rights leader who I think was the same age as you at the time, about 18. And what apparently offended him was that he was sitting on his porch and the National Guard that were called in were roaming around the streets of Watts in jeeps with big machine guns mounted on them, and that these soldiers pointed the machine gun at him and ordered him to get off his own porch, and in doing so used the N-word. So what was the first thing that got you feeling like what is happening in America?
Well, the memory is one that I'll always carry with me. The event itself, the precipitating event, which was the confrontation between Marquette Frye, his brother, and his mother with the LAPD on 116th Street in Avalon, was not that very far from where I lived in the Jordan Downs Project. I want to point out that where this took place was really just outside the boundaries of the city of Watts, which is really about 3 square miles, if you will, bordered Central Avenue on the west. Avalon is maybe a mile outside to the west of Central Avenue. But we heard about it almost immediately. I can remember I was on my front porch with a group of friends, or about four or five of us, when we heard, and somebody in the group made the decision, hey, let's go over and see what's happening. I had a car at that time, my first car, 52 Chevy, and we got in it, and I remember driving over. We parked maybe some blocks from it, but I can remember going down 103rd Street, which would later be called Charco Alley, number one. That was one block from where I lived on 102nd. When we got to 103rd and Avalon, and then turned south, headed towards 116th, you could see the difference. The streets were packed on both sides, and I grew up there. And in all those years, I had never seen the streets like that. When I say packed, I'm not just talking about people going about their business on both sides. Crowd, mob, most of all the atmosphere. It was like a change in the mood, attention. You could feel it. And as we drove further south, the crowd thickened, if anything. And then when it hit me what this was, and I'm talking about early evening, we got to what must have been between 108th and 110th, maybe about five blocks from the scene, Ian, when I saw the most horrific thing happened. A crowd chasing a man. The man was a Hispanic. And when I say a crowd, it looked like hundreds of them. And he literally running for his life, and he fell. And the crowd descended on him like just a wild pack. And it wasn't even 20 seconds, 30 seconds, I don't know if it was that long, but it's like they descended on him, and when they backed off, he was laying there bleeding and battered like a rag doll. I mean, we were in the car looking at, I gagged when I saw it. I was horrified, but that's when it struck me that this was going to be unlike anything I'd ever seen. I've told people that the events of those 5-6 days would change my life, because keep in mind, I'm only 3 months from having come back from a year at Harvard as the first African-American to get a full academic grad to Harvard University. And I'm 3 months back, and then I see this, and like I said, that's when it hit. Sobering, horrifying. I mean, we turned around and headed back to our home, you know, in the projects. And real interesting, because the projects always had this reputation as a place of violence, but that was very, very calm place compared to what was happening just blocks from where we lived. And sure, later as the uprising intensified, the National Guard came in. I can remember the tanks rolling down the streets, the National Guard setting up machine gun nests. It was a war zone. That's what it was.
And again, I'm speaking with Johnny Scott, who's an Associate Professor and Director of External and Community Projects at the Department of Africana Studies at California State University. He's one of the original founding members of the Watts Writers Workshop, and he attended the 1966 White House Conference to fulfill these rights called by then-President Lyndon Johnson, where he represented the Watts community. And in the immediate aftermath of the revolt, he served as a member of the Board of Directors for the Watts branch of the NAACP and was one of the co-founders of the Sons of Watts, the Greater Watts Justice Center, the Studio Watts Workshop with James Woods, Maya Angelou, Ornette Coleman, and Jane Cortez, and the Mafundi Institute with Bill Marshall. Now, isn't it a bit of an irony then, Johnny, that back then in 65, Watts was, about 80% black and 20% Hispanic, and now it's completely reversed, where it's about 80% Hispanic and 20% black?
That's a good point, but I'd say even more so. Back then, Watts was closer to 90%. Mm-hmm. Black. Hispanics making up like 10% of the population. Well, maybe about 8, and then there was a small smattering of Japanese. 2 points I want to make, though. When one looks at the early history, the founding of Watts back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, it had the name Mudtown. That was because it was a farming community. The original population was majority Hispanic. And then Japanese and blacks made up a small group, because blacks then moving into Los Angeles from the south were on the east side closer to downtown, 1st and 2nd Street. And as the black population grew, they migrated from downtown L.A., if you will, into Watts. It wasn't until the 1920s when blacks became a large a majority in Watts that the city was then annexed as such and moved forward. So that then for World War II, of course, many blacks moved to the West because of the jobs. In Long Beach, the shipyards, that kind of thing. And again, it remained predominantly black up until the mid-1990s. The other point that I want to make, it occurs to me, referring back to that first day I just described going out there. I remember coming back with my friends. We sat down and talked about, we were angry, as were a lot of people where we lived in Watts, because we were being blamed. L.A. was very territorial, if you will. We felt we were being blamed for something that was not Watts. When I say we, that our neighborhood, our community, was being blamed for something that happened outside our borders. But then the irony was that it wasn't a day or two later that the media, the broadcast media, began describing Watts in an entirely new way. Watts had all of a sudden expanded to go from northern border of Manchester Avenue to Washington Boulevard, from Central Avenue now to Crenshaw, from Imperial Highway to Alondra, and then the Alameda border. In other words, we went from those three, roughly 4 square miles I talked about originally in, to 55 square miles, you know, and all of it was the reference in terms of where blacks lived in Los Angeles, so that Watts, if you will, was wherever a black person lived.
Well, given that there's a familiar pattern here of uprisings since Watts being precipitated by police harassing, beating, or killing African Americans after a traffic stop, you know, all we can say is that we haven't come a long way, I think. And the other issue in the last couple of minutes I'd like to have you address, if you don't mind, Johnny, is that when we talk about improvements made since 1965, how does that gel with the fact that unemployment amongst black youth in America today stands at 30%?
I think you've hit the nail on the head, because at that same time, 50 years ago, unemployment in Watts was running right around the same. It's been chronic double-digit unemployment and watch the last 50 years. That has not changed. In fact, according to one good friend of mine, Tim Watkins of the Watts Labor Community Action Coalition, in pockets of South Los Angeles, that unemployment where blacks, if you will, and browns are concerned, runs closer to 70%. We're talking about the urban poor, the dispossessed. And I think there's when people are without work, and then not just without work, they've been out of work for a long time. Many have simply given up hope of ever getting gainful employment. That's when they turn to other means to survive. I'm not, you know, saying this to rationalize, let's say, crime or anything, but people are going to do what they have to do in order to survive, or as they say in the community, make ends meet.
So in terms of the familiarity, though, of, you know, Rodney King, what just happened down in Texas, the young woman being pulled over and found later...
Sandra Bland,
later found dead in the cell. There is a depressing familiarity there, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And one of the things that I'm kind of reminded of when we talk about Watts and the 50th anniversary, Watts was not the first urban uprising. So just a year before, there had been eight similar uprisings, but those were all on the East Coast. But a point that needs to be made with Watts is that 1965, in the next 3 years, there would be 274 urban uprisings in this country. The tinderbox across the country, and when we look at the point I'm making, when we look at how this violence, this rift between black America, and I don't want to just simply say law enforcement. I'm going to say these unjust practices. It's happening all over. It's not in any one spot. So if anything, the ashes are there. They're still smoldering. The potential is, I'm kind of surprised, to tell the truth, that we haven't seen an outbreak. God knows I hope not, but when people are left hopeless and in this sense, because we need police. Let's be frank about it. We need police in any society, but when you get to people that have lost faith in those that are sworn to protect and serve, then we've got a serious problem.
Well, Johnny Scott, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time.
Okay, and thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And again, I've been speaking with Johnny Scott, who's a professor and director of external and community projects at the Department of Africana Studies at California State University, Northridge. He's one of the original founding members of the Watts Writers Workshop, and he attended the 1966 White House Conference to Fulfill These Rights, called by then-President Lyndon Johnson, where he represented the Watts community. And in the immediate aftermath of the revolt, he served as a member of the board of the directors of the Watts branch of the NAACP and was one of the co-founders of the Sons of Watts, the Greater Watts Justice Center, and the Watts Studio Workshop with James Woods, Maya Angelou, Ornette Coleman, and Jane Cortez, and the Mafundi Institute with Bill Marshall. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Ari Berman about his new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
You don't need to change the future's eye. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ari Berman, a political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His writing has also appeared in The New York Times and Rolling Stone, and he is a frequent commentator on MSNBC and NPR, and he has an article at Politico, Inside John Roberts' Decades-Long Crusade Against the Voting Rights Act, and his latest book just out is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And just a few days ago at the White House, President Obama, on the actual 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, with Attorney General Loretta Lynch and Representative John Lewis of Georgia, who was badly beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the famous Selma Civil Rights March, which a movie was made about quite recently. What the president said is that the Voting Rights Act is one of the crowning achievements of our democracy, but he also went on to say that the law stands weakened, its future subject to political rancor. In light of your book, I'd say that's an understatement.
Yeah, it is an understatement, and I was actually sitting 10 feet away from the president when he was talking and listening to him talk about the Voting Rights Act. And what the president said was that everyone theoretically believes in the right to vote. Everyone says they believe in the right to vote, but in practice, far too many people are restricting the right to vote. Both states across the country and also the Supreme Court with gutting the Voting Rights Act. And what I tried to show with my book is that there's been incredible progress as a result of the VRA, that the Voting Rights Act transformed American democracy and actually, in fact, made America a democracy, which we were not before the passage of the VRA, but also that there's been a 50-year effort to roll back the Voting Rights Act. And that effort started immediately after the VRA was passed, continued in the decades after the law was enforced, and has really reached a pinnacle in recent years with all these states making it harder to vote and the Supreme Court gutting the VRA, the most important part of the VRA. So the anniversary of the VRA this year was a very somber one.
But is there any way that you can name and shame the counter-revolutionaries, the people that would turn back progress? And I spoke the other day with Bernie Sanders, and he was quite passionate, saying, you know, these people are cowards. He said, in a democracy, you should be able to stand up for what you believe in. You shouldn't have to resort to these underhand tactics and deny you people that don't agree with you the vote. My sense is that these are the same people, by the way, and this applies to almost all politicians, who redistrict to their own benefit. So is it possible to name and shame politicians?
Well, I mean, I think we should. I mean, that's what I've been doing in my reporting on this subject, and that's what I've been doing in my book, and just to show how broadly sweeping the counter-revolution has been. And you're absolutely right that it is a very cowardly thing to do to try to prevent people from voting. It shows that you don't have good ideas. If you had good ideas, you would try to get people to vote for you on the basis of your ideas, not pass laws that make it harder for those people that are opposed to your ideas, make it harder for them to vote. And so I think what we're seeing now with voter ID laws and cutting early voting and shutting down voter registration drives is a new iteration of an old battle, a new iteration of the poll taxes and the literacy tests that we saw 50 years ago. And I think we've entered a whole new struggle of voting rights after we thought that the battle had been won. I mean, I think many people thought that Barack Obama's victory solidified the promise of the Voting Rights Act, not really realizing that there would be a whole new attack on voting rights following Obama's election.
Well, it seems to me that what you've brought to the table here, Ari Berman, in your new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and your article at Politico, Inside John Roberts' Decade-Long Crusade Against the Voting Rights Act, is to sort of show, in a way, how John Roberts and the Supreme Court, the role that they played, how pivotal has been in the voting rights counter-revolution, and in fact, how pivotal the Chief Justice himself has been. I recall recently Linda Greenhouse, the New York Times, long-time observer of the Supreme Court, a very fair person, who wrote a kind of article that was a cri de coeur, if you will, where she said, you know, I've resisted for the longest time looking upon the conservative majority of this court as Republican political operatives in robes, but I'm afraid I'm coming to that conclusion. And it's pretty hard not to come to the conclusion. If you look at Citizens United combined with stripping Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, that has been basically a huge boon for the Republican Party.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, but I think it actually goes deeper than that. That I think it's actually even more disturbing to just call them Republicans, I think, to some extent, takes them off the hook, that this is just about partisanship. But I think if you look at John Roberts, he's been motivated for three decades to try to gut the Voting Rights Act. That when he was first a clerk for Justice William Rehnquist, the most conservative member of the court at the time, and then when he was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department, he repeatedly tried to weaken the Voting Rights Act. This was, by all accounts, one of his chief passions, was to limit the civil rights laws of the 1960s. And since he's been on the court, one of his signature projects as Chief Justice has been to limit the VRA and the related historic civil rights efforts. And so I think with Roberts, it's not just partisanship at work, but it's a much deeper ideology that downplays the existence of racism in society, that says that historic protections against discrimination are no longer needed. And I think that's a very, very dangerous attitude, particularly at a time when we're seeing a resurgence of activism and interest and on civil rights and a whole new wave of killings and protests that brings to mind some of the things that we saw in the 1960s.
And when you talk about William Rehnquist, the Supreme Court Justice, who John Roberts clerked for, I recall at his confirmation hearing that Senator Kennedy showed video of Rehnquist as a young man challenging black voters in Arizona mm-hmm. at the polls, which was really quite disgraceful. It's something that anybody who believes in democracy just cannot believe that this is happening and has happened here in the United States. So it's hard to understand his mentality. He was apparently known, according to your article at Politico, as the Lone Ranger because of his ultra-conservatism. And he also, when he worked for Justice Jackson in trying to uphold an all-white primary for the Texas Democrat Club, he said, "It's about time the court faced the fact that the white people of the South do not like the colored people." That's a pretty extraordinary thing that he go under the radar or something? What happened? Why was he considered, you know, a reasonable person all those years? Or was he not? Maybe I'm wrong there.
Well, it's remarkable that, you know, all these memos were raised that you just quoted, all these allegations were raised against Rehnquist, and he just essentially denied all of them. He either said that despite all the testimony that he didn't try to prevent blacks and Hispanics from voting, or that he didn't agree with the memos that he had once written. He somehow found his way out of all these jams. But you're absolutely right that he was extremely conservative on civil rights issues, to the point where many of the things that he did and said were outright racist things. And he was on the court at a time following the heyday of the liberal Earl Warren Court in the 1960s. Rehnquist goes on in 71 as a Nixon appointee, and he is someone who is so out there compared to his colleagues, so right-wing compared to his colleagues. And then what happens is the court drifts further and further to the right, first through Nixon's appointments, then through Reagan's appointments, and Rehnquist then becomes the leader of the court. The Chief Justice of the court under the Reagan administration, and indeed his proteges, people like John Roberts, the new generation of conservatives on the court, Antonin Scalia, Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, they are in fact more conservative than Rehnquist. So here you have a guy who it didn't seem like you could be any further to the right than William Rehnquist. But the way he operated was, if anything, less conservative than these new justices on the Supreme Court. And that just goes to show you how far to the right the Supreme Court has moved and how far to the right the Republican Party and the conservative movement has moved.
Well, that's one of the things I think that the proportionality of what you're saying is not ever properly addressed by the press, who routinely talks about the conservatives who dominate the court and the liberals who oppose them. They're the 5-4 split. I don't believe that, you know, it's hard to know that there are any liberals on that court compared to William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall and others in past decades. You could argue that there's 5 or 4 far-right guys, 1 right-wing guy, and 4 centrists.
Well, you're absolutely right that the liberals on the court are nowhere near as liberal as the conservatives on the court are conservative. And not only that, but they don't come out of a liberal movement, by and large, the liberals on the court. The conservatives on the court are all steeped in conservative dogma. And I just, in my book, I just wrote about the example of John Roberts. And John Roberts comes up really through, you know, conservative boot camp. He comes up through Rehnquist and Reagan. And these are people who are launching a huge counter-revolution in the law. And Roberts is one of those foot soldiers. And so Roberts is ascending through the Republican Party, through the conservative legal network, as it's becoming more and more conservative and more hard-edged. And so Roberts seems very reasonable when he testifies for his confirmation hearings as Chief Justice. He seems like a perfectly reasonable, nice Midwestern guy. But that veneer belies the fact that deep down, he is a hard-edged movement conservative, and one of his signature projects as Chief Justice and as a lawyer 3 decades earlier has been to try to gut the Voting Rights Act and the civil rights laws of the 1960s. He's never voted in a way on the court to uphold any of these measures.
Well, let's talk for a while, if you don't mind, Ari Berman, about the role that John Roberts played in Florida in 2000, given that there's the impression that he was essentially rewarded by George W. Bush for his efforts being made the Chief Justice. Now, I think the caveat, though, would be that, of course, Al Gore, his first decision, presidential decision, was to choose out Lieberman as his running mate. His second presidential decision was to concede an election that he had won. So given that caveat, walk us through John Roberts' role in Florida.
Sure. Well, I could just give something of the backstory, which is that there was a massive voter purge in Florida before the election, where tens of thousands of people were wrongly labeled as felons and prevented from voting and purged from the voting rolls. And so on election day, many people showed up, were told they were felons and were unable to vote. And these were disproportionately African-American voters. African-Americans were 11% of the population in Florida, but they comprised 44% of those who were purged from the voting rolls. And so that was a whole backdrop to Florida, the fact that there were thousands of people, overwhelmingly African-American, who were disenfranchised in that state. And then there was a whole host of other problems in terms of why ballots weren't counted for one reason or another. And Roberts comes down to Florida on the invitation of another guy whose name will be familiar, Ted Cruz, because Ted Cruz, who at that time is a 29-year-old policy director of the Bush team, is leading the Bush campaign's legal efforts. And Cruz invites Roberts to Florida because Cruz is a former Rehnquist clerk as well. So you can just see the influence of William Rehnquist right here with Ted Cruz and John Roberts. And Cruz invites Roberts down and basically says, Roberts is one of the smartest lawyers I know. We need to get him on the case. And Roberts helps the Bush team fashion the legal briefs and the arguments they're going to use before the Supreme Court to prevent all ballots from being counted. He also advises Jeb Bush as to what he should do, because Florida is also considering potentially just awarding its electors to George W. Bush, regardless of what the courts do, which would have been totally unprecedented. And Roberts is advising him too. And what we see is that after Roberts goes to Florida and advises the Bush campaign, that the Supreme Court sides with the Bush campaign and decides not to have all of the ballots counted. And what happens is that allows George W. Bush to be elected, and 5 years after that, John Roberts is made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And so you can really see that, you know, all the future leaders of the conservative movement and the Republican Party are present in this 2000 election debacle in Florida.
And of course, I think universally legal scholars, whether they're conservative or liberal, have to admit that Bush v. Gore was a, shall we say, out of character and contradictory to the principles of the originalists like Scalia and company, particularly those who believe in states' rights.
Well, and it was an absolutely absurd decision. And first, it was that no justice even wanted to put its name on the decision because it was so controversial and poorly written. But also, they decided this under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was supposed to give full citizenship to African Americans after the Civil War. And so you have a situation where African Americans are disproportionately prevented from voting in Florida, but yet it's the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment that's invoked to prevent their votes from being counted, which is deeply ironic. And there's a story that I tell in the book that was originally told by the New Yorker Jeffrey Toobin, where Ruth Bader Ginsburg is making this exact point, saying if there's any equal protection violation in Florida, it's because ballots cast by African Americans were disproportionately not counted. And her closest friend on the court, Justice Scalia, objects to what he calls her quote-unquote Al Sharpton footnote. And it's taken out. Her reference is taken out of the piece, of the opinion. And it's just remarkable that there's this whole wave of voter disenfranchisement in Florida, and the Supreme Court just doesn't acknowledge any of it in its opinion.
Well, going back to the 50th anniversary, which we just recently observed, I recall that President Johnson, when he signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, he commented to his aides that we've just lost the South. We, the Democrats, have just lost the South. And we know that Nixon came in with the so-called Southern strategy. And now we also know that essentially the Republican Party has become a Southern party.
Yeah.
So my sense, though, is that in many ways, the Civil War itself, particularly in the South, has always mystified me to the extent to that white Southerners were fighting for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves, and that sort of mentality and the right to work movements that have captured the South indicate to me, and I remember speaking recently with Michael Lind, who wrote a book about the history of the American economy. He made the point that, and he's a Southerner, he made the point that it's never really been, it's all about race overtly, but really the real subtext and the real point about the South and its kind of Tory sort of oligarchic structure, the plantation economy that still persists in the South, is that the South has always been about cheap labor.
Well, can I just say that I think it's a little bit more complicated in terms of the Voting Rights Act's effect on the South, because LBJ said that we've just lost the South. He was talking about the Civil Rights Act of 1964,
sure. Yeah,
although I do think there was an element of he believed that with the VRA as well. I think the VRA did two things in the South. It did lead to a Southernization of the Republican Party, and it did make the Republican Party a lot more conservative, because candidates like Richard Nixon and then Ronald Reagan courted the white Southern conservative vote. And as more black voters flocked to the Democratic Party, that meant that more conservative whites tended to flock to the Republican Party. Now, but the flip side of that is that the VRA also made possible the election not just of many black politicians, people like Andrew Young and John Lewis, civil rights leaders who have never been elected to Congress otherwise, but it also led at various times to a coalition of African Americans and progressive whites that resulted in the election of moderate white Democrats like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton becoming president. And this is historic, too. And so when people say that the VRA just handed the Republican Party to the South, well, my rejoinder is that, yes, it did that, but it also led to John Lewis being elected to Congress and to Jimmy Carter and to Bill Clinton and ultimately Barack Obama being president. So I think it's a complicated story. I think it's one where the law did what it was supposed to do, but there were also some unintended consequences as well.
But I think going back to what we're talking about in terms of John Roberts and the Supreme Court with both Citizens United and getting rid of Section 5 of the VRA, it does seem like a kind of King Canute trying to hold back the tide in terms of a strategy because of the demographic changes underway as America becomes less white and more multicultural.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's been an effort to make it harder for these ascendant communities to vote, and I think it's absolutely being driven by demographics and political change. I think it's an attempt to make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative, as opposed to, you know, younger, more progressive, and more diverse, like it was in 2008 and 2012. And I also think you're right that the money that's flowing in the political system, the attempt to buy the elections, is an attempt also to drown out the vote of all these people who aren't billionaires. And so, I mean, I think, you know, in faced with these incredibly changing demographics, instead of reaching out to these new constituencies, the Republican Party is trying to structure the election in such a way that the wealthiest and the whitest people have the most say.
Well, Ari Berman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who's a political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His writing has also appeared in The New York Times and Rolling Stone, and he is a frequent commentator on MSNBC and NPR, and he has an article at Politico inside John Roberts' decades-long crusade against the Voting Rights Act. And his latest book just out is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the disconnect between Donald Trump continuing to lead in the Republican primary polls while the punditry continues to write off his chances of winning the nomination. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you.
And Donald Trump is winning in the polls, but losing the nomination, we're told. And on the other side, Bernie Sanders is drawing the biggest crowds of any candidate. He had 28,000 people here in Los Angeles last night with an overflow crowd, mostly young and a diverse group of minorities present. And yet we're told he doesn't have a chance of getting the nomination. So explain to me the logic of the punditry here.
Well, I think the punditry is dead wrong about Donald Trump. They've been predicting for some time now that Donald Trump would fizzle out, he'd fade away, he'd be another Herman Cain or Michelle Bachmann and quickly disappear from the Republican scene. And that has not happened. Every time they make the prediction, he seems to get stronger and stronger in the polls. Not only is he leading in the generic nomination polls, he's leading in every single poll in the early primary states, and in Florida is dead even with Jeb Bush. It's just been extraordinary. Trump is not going to fade, and while it's hard to predict the Republican nomination with so many candidates, if I had to predict one candidate who is most likely to get the nomination, it's Donald Trump. Why? First of all, he is saying things, particularly about immigrants, that other Republicans believe but are afraid to say. And thus, he is appealing to a segment of the Republican electorate that no other candidate is really reaching. He also has a certain authenticity about him, as outrageous as it may seem. And perhaps most critically, the rest of the field has proven to be a real group of duds. Nobody but nobody has really risen to the fore to become a serious challenger against Donald Trump. Everybody thought, and again, the smart money said, it's going to be Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush has proven to be the biggest dud of all. I can't prove this, but I truly believe that Jeb Bush doesn't have the fire in his belly, doesn't really desperately want to be president, that he's kind of doing it because he's expected to do it. His dad was president. His brother was president. Now it's his turn. Well, that doesn't work. Can't win the presidency without the fire in the belly. So Trump isn't going away. He may not get the nomination, but right now I'd rate him the front runner. On the Democratic side, I think it's a very good thing that Bernie Sanders is attracting big crowds and bringing out young people. The Democratic Party needs young people. They need young people to vote. That's the momentous engine of the Democratic Party. And he seems to be pushing Hillary Clinton to take more progressive positions. Witness her coming out with a major program of collegiate aid. I don't believe that he can get the Democratic nomination. And I do believe if there's a big bloody contest for the Democratic nomination, the only beneficiaries are going to be the Republicans. It's a very bad thing for the party holding the White House to have a bloody nomination fight. Look at what happened to the Republicans in 2008 or the Democrats in 1980 or the Republicans in 1976. It doesn't work. But if he can excite voters and push Hillary Clinton to be more progressive, I think that's a good thing for the party. And I think it would be a very bad thing for the party if Joe Biden came into the race. He adds nothing. Bernie Sanders adds something to the Democratic mix. Joe Biden's an old-time pal. He doesn't add anything, and he would just make a nomination contest more likely.
You just mentioned, Alan Lichtman, that Jeb Bush doesn't have fire in the belly. That sort of reminds me of Al Gore. He seemed to have the same affliction. Would you see a comparison there?
Yeah, I think Al Gore didn't have the fire in the belly. He kind of got the fire after he lost the presidential election, but didn't really seem to have the stomach to fight for it, as witnessed the fact that the Republicans so badly thrashed him in the battle for Florida. He was too timid. He made too many mistakes. He'd never called early on for a full-scale recount in every county, and he got beaten. I think the case of kind of ashes in the belly is even a bit worse for Jeb Bush than it was for Al Gore. You know, in many ways, this nomination has been for the taking for Jeb Bush, but he's been just too diffident to seize it. And, you know, obviously in politics, as the great Disraeli once said, finality is not a word that we use. And I wouldn't write him off quite yet, but I do think he's a sinking rather than a sailing ship right now.
And just apropos of what you were just saying then, Alan, the latest poll out today on the Republican field in Iowa, a new Suffolk University poll, finds that Donald Trump still leads, and that former Florida Governor Jeb Bush has sunk to seventh place from third in the Real Clear Politics Iowa poll over the last month. And now he's basically trailing the CEO, Carly Fiorina, who didn't even get in the debates in Iowa. And the winner post-Republican debate appears to be Senator Marco Rubio, who scored his biggest boost, rising from eighth place to third place.
That's just extraordinary that Bush should be in seventh place. Is he behind Ben Carson?
I haven't got the full list. Trump leads.
Okay, but Trump, I think that would be the most embarrassing thing in the world for Jeb Bush, to be behind Ben Carson, a man with no political experience, who says the most outrageous, most morally offensive things, such as comparing Barack Obama to Adolf Hitler, a man who started a war that killed 67 million people and murdered in cold blood 6 million Jews. You know, imagine being behind a guy like that. It's just a very sad commentary on just how pathetic the Jeb Bush campaign should be. But the big loser in Iowa may be Republican Governor Walker, you know, of Wisconsin. You know, Iowa is close in geographic proximity. It's his backyard. He was leading early on in the polls in Iowa. It was his best chance to make a real splash in this race. And the fact that he's now fallen behind, I guess, the New Yorker Donald Trump is pretty sad for Scott Walker.
Right. Well, in this poll, though, Trump leads the field at 17%. He's certainly down. And Governor Walker comes in at 12%, with Rubio at 10%. So he's not exactly wiped out, but he certainly, I mean, frankly,
He should be 10, 15 points ahead in Iowa.
Exactly. But, you know, he's probably the scariest of all of the candidates, because I think as a human being, I think he's a very venal, nasty person. I mean, everything one hears about him and his policies, he's totally in the pocket of the Koch brothers. And, you know, I know I'm editorializing here, but he's the guy that most worries me, but I don't think he's making it. Now, what I find extraordinary about this whole process is that Fox News is reaping what it sows. It built up the Tea Party. Clearly, Murdoch and Ailes instructed the Fox people to ambush and try and destroy Donald Trump. They started out of the gate trying to knock him out with the first question of you know, are you going to run as a third-party candidate? And then after the debate, Megyn Kelly joined in with the pollster Frank Luntz, and they had a group of hand-picked Republican voters there who then continued trashing Trump. And guess what? He was in the Reuters Ipsos poll that came out yesterday. Trump's at 24% and Jeb Bush is at 12%.
Yeah, let's maybe say that, you know, if the biggest loser out of the debate was Jeb Bush, the second biggest loser was definitely Fox News. Voters have minds of their own within the Republican Party. And as important as Fox News is, and you can't underestimate its power, it can't control everything. And it has created its own Frankenstein monster that has now turned on its creator. No doubt about that, by whipping up so much of this Tea Party type sentiment.
So today, Jeb Bush made a major foreign policy speech, and he basically brought back his brother's doctrine, the Bush doctrine.
Good luck with that.
I was going to say, evoking the surge. That's what we need in Iraq, another surge. And of course, the surge essentially was a political device that Petraeus and company came up with to simply get Bush and Cheney out of this mess that they got themselves in. They simply didn't know what to do. And they came up with this cosmetic idea of getting out and paying the Sunni tribes to get rid of al-Qaeda. And now, of course, these are the same Sunni tribes that we just sold out, who've now essentially joined ISIS. But what I take from what Bush was saying today, that the Republican plan in terms of foreign policy, if they get back in, is to reignite the Iraq war.
That seems to be their only plan. And, you know, it's even worse than that. Because look at the opposition to the Iran treaty. Think about it. If you defeat the Iran treaty, what are the alternatives? Number one, a nuclear-armed Iran. Assume that's not going to be tolerated. All right, so what are your options? You can try to continue the sanctions. But the sanctions haven't worked. The same people who are criticizing the Iran treaty are the same folks who are saying Iran's building a bomb despite the sanctions. Moreover, the sanctions will be vastly weaker because the European allies are not going to go along with it. So if a nuclear weapon's intolerable and the sanctions won't work, what is the alternative? Another war in the Middle East. Think it through. That is the inevitable logic of the Republican position. And unfortunately, some Democrats like Charles Schumer, who has succeeded in doing something I thought was not possible, making me ashamed to be a native New Yorker. Charles Schumer was wrong on the Iraq War. He learned nothing from being wrong on the Iraq War. He's now wrong on the Iran treaty and is a craven coward, caving into special interests within his constituency, even though he has perhaps the safest Senate seat, or certainly one of the safest Senate seats in the country. It's a real crying shame to see Schumer doing this.
Well, I would think, though, Alan Lichtman, as an American political historian, isn't there a case to be made that not just what you've made against Schumer, but in the very most basic sense that, you know, the oath of office for all of these congressmen, senators, and the president is to uphold and swear allegiance to the Constitution of the United States. If they vote down this deal, and if to the extent that they override Obama's expected veto, this will be a huge blow to the American Constitution and the constitutional prerogatives of presidents from now on, because no country in the world is going to want to make a deal with an American president if the thing can be unraveled by the Congress. It's just
that's another, you know, horrific side effect of this effort to overturn the treaty. As you know, the Republicans would have been against the treaty if Iran had agreed to become a province of the United States. Didn't matter what was in the treaty. They were against it before they even read it. But you would expect something more from some of these Democrats like Chuck Schumer. But I still believe that even if it's voted down, that there won't be enough votes to override a presidential veto. And I think no matter what the bombast coming out of Republicans, if a Republican were to win, it's going to be very difficult for that new president to simply abrogate this treaty and just let Iran run amok and get nuclear weapons.
Well, just back to Donald Trump, Alan Lichtman, what I find in a curious way refreshing about him, even though he's boorish and racist and disgraceful and obviously a showman, and that this whole thing, there's something sort of mischievous about the whole thing, the way he appears to be manipulating the media and manipulating the Republican Party. But the one thing about him, which I find refreshing, even though it's very distasteful, and that is that for the longest time, Republicans have been using dog whistle politics in these coded racist messages, and they always use them, and then they say, oh, heavens forbid, you know, we're not being racist, you know, that's not what we said. So they've done it in a very coded way, and that's been their MO now for decades. Trump is now dog whistle up front, no disguising it, plain and simple. I mean, he's really basically saying right out front what they've been saying in coded messages.
I think I said this right off the bat. You're absolutely right. He is saying things that other Republican candidates might believe, and certainly a swath of the Republican electorate believes, but none of the Republican candidates, particularly the more establishment types, have been willing to come out and say and voice and articulate any of these things publicly. So it does give a certain authenticity to Trump and a certain appeal to the segment of the Republican Party that wants to hear these things and has not been hearing it, except perhaps in this coded way from other candidates. I also think there's something appealing about Trump, leaving aside all these issues, in that if you get Scott Walker, you know what you're going to get. You already articulated that. You don't know what you're going to get with Donald Trump. Wasn't that long ago that he was a liberal, you know, that he was pro-choice, that he was for a single-payer health care plan? Who knows how Donald Trump might govern? And there's a certain degree of unpredictability there that isn't there for a Ted Cruz or a Scott Walker or a Jeb Bush or, you know, any of the rest of the group. You kind of know what you're getting with them. You don't know what you're getting with Trump.
Well, just in closing, do you think that he is going to last? I mean, he's winning. That's what's so strange. He's winning in the polls and losing the nomination. At least that's the mixed message we're getting from reality versus the punditry. So I'm just wondering, since that punditry's been so wrong, is this guy...
Pundits are always wrong.
Yeah, but is he going to go all the way then? I mean...
Look, as I said at the beginning, I'm not willing to predict that Trump is going to win the nomination. It's too hard with so many candidates to make a prediction. But if I had to pick which one of the 17 was more likely than any of the others to win, it would definitely be Donald Trump. You know, nobody else has really stepped up and captured the imagination of the Republican electorate or really stood out in any significant way. Now, it's a long way to go, obviously, and a lot can happen. But right now, I think the pundits are wrong. You cannot count out Donald Trump. They've already counted him out three or four times, and every single time they've done so, he has astounded and surprised them.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, Ian, take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.